Today on the 21st, should the Electoral College decide who becomes president?
I think that it has a very important role in terms of protecting minorities.
That's NPR's Cookie Roberts. This Monday, the Electoral College will officially select the next president of the United States. Today, we delve into the process. And how about books as holiday gifts this year? Two librarians share their top picks for children and grown-ups. And we want you to share your ideas, too. What books are you considering gifting this year? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or tweet 21STshow. Plus, Chicago singer Lucy Smith joins us to talk about her new album, Singing Christmas and the Holidays.
It's an opportunity for us to actually look at each other in the face and greet each other, even if it's in a generic way, to say things about love and peace and community and togetherness.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The midnight clear, the glory. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. On Monday, the Electoral College will officially decide upon the next president of the United States. Every 4 years, we have a discussion about the Electoral College, whether it works. This year, it's been especially controversial. Maybe you've seen the number of op-eds criticizing the Electoral College system. One Republican elector from Texas wrote in the New York Times he would not vote for President-elect Donald Trump on Monday. Harvard University law professor Larry Lessig has said this week he knows of 20 GOP electors who say they might not vote for Trump. On the legal website Verdict, constitutional law scholar Vikram Amar has been writing that electors should vote as directed and not by their personal preference or who they think should be the president. He's also the dean of the University of Illinois Law School, and he's in studio with me now. Vic, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you, Nyla.
I think we like to think of as Americans, we honor this democratic principle of one person, one vote. But then the Electoral College system kind of really messes with that.
Yeah, there are really two deviations from the one person, one vote principle. The U.S. Senate, where every state has two senators, regardless of whether you're a small state like Montana or Wyoming or a giant state like Illinois or California. And then the Electoral College. And Electoral College actually deviates in two ways. First, because the formula for how many electors each state gets incorporates the fact that every state has two senators. There's some inequality built into the system that way. But then, moreover, because each state's votes are counted separately and each state picks its electors and they vote independently of the electors of other states, the margin of victory that you win or lose by in any state if you're running for president is irrelevant. All that matters is whether you win or lose. And so you can have a situation of the kind we had in 2000 or again this year where the national popular vote winner loses in the Electoral College. And any time the person who got more votes in the country is not made president, then you know some people's votes are counting more than others.
And you've made the argument in the past that this is a system you've criticized. And I want to get to that in a minute. But let's just talk about what's going to happen on Monday, because we've seen lots of news stories about what's going to take place on Monday, whether or not people will, whether the electors will vote for who they're supposed to be voting for based on their states. We've had people like Harvard Law professor Larry Lessig saying that people should vote their conscience. He's been offering legal advice. Why do you disagree with that?
Well, first of all, it's not entirely clear to me at all that electors have the legal right to vote their own conscience rather than the way that state law directs them to. And in virtually every state, state law says that the electors shall vote for the candidate who won the most votes in that state. Some states back up that requirement with criminal sanctions or civil fines and the like. And the Supreme Court has never come close to saying that that's problematic. This idea that electors clearly have independence to do what they want is out there, but it's not a legally tested idea.
Do you know what the laws are in Illinois, or is it criminal? Is it a criminal prosecution
here? I don't think there's a criminal sanction, but I'm not that familiar with Illinois' laws specifically.
Theoretically, though, if someone didn't vote for who they were supposed to, you're saying they could actually be criminally prosecuted.
In some states, there are criminal laws that go out. So, for example, you saw in Colorado some electors who were under the umbrella of a state law that imposed criminal sanctions on faithlessness by electors. They tried to go to court last week and get a judge to free them of those laws. And the judge says, no, you got to abide by those laws. Other states say if an elector votes differently than he or she is supposed to, then the vote doesn't count. And in fact, that faithless vote should be taken as a resignation of office. So the elector is basically no longer an elector once they vote faithlessly. And then the other electors can replace that vacancy with someone who's going to vote the way state law requires. So as a legal matter, it's not clear to me that these electors have the power to do what some want them to do. Although historically, there have been a number of occasions where one or a couple of electors are faithless, but it never mattered because they did so in the context of an election that was overwhelming.
That wasn't okay. But you've also made the even broader argument that if electors were to do this to sort of vote who they felt like voting for, essentially, this is essentially, to your mind, a constitutional crisis in a way.
Yeah, I just don't see where they get the moral as opposed to or in addition to the legal authority to do it. Larry Lessig, whom I admire and respect and consider a friend, his argument is that because Ms. Clinton won more votes nationwide, she's the real choice of the people, and therefore Trump electors should actually vote for and elect Hillary Clinton as president. The problem with that is we don't really know who would have won the most popular votes in the nation had the candidates really run campaigns built around winning popular votes. We have this thing called the Electoral College. I wish we didn't, but we do. And even Mr. Trump has said quite rightly he may have been able to rack up more votes in places like Texas and other red states, and he might have been able to do damage control and minimize the margin of loss in some blue states. So if he had known that the name of the game was the national popular vote, maybe he would have won that. So it's hard to know after the fact who would have had more votes. So it's not clear to me that Ms. Clinton is the choice of the American people any more than Donald Trump is. Moreover, everyone who does vote is not really voting for an elector that they think should exercise independent judgment. I defy you to ask how many people out there on November 8th really expected and desired that the electors from their state that they were voting for would be free agents. I just don't think that's the way the Americans approach the election. So if we're really trying to honor the will of the people, doing something very different than all the voters expected on November 8th doesn't seem to me a very good way to do that.
So interesting. One of the producers just pointed out to me that according to Ballotopedia, Illinois is one of 20 states in 2016 that doesn't have a law that seeks to bind the votes of presidential electors. What does that mean? What if we're saying doesn't seek to bind the vote? Does that mean that
it means that there's no formal state law that imposes sanctions on an elector who votes other than expected? But even in states that don't have a formal binding statute, either criminal or civil, they still pick electors who take a pledge within the party when they are selected as electors to vote for the party's nominee should the voters of that state pick that party as the one that won on November 8th.
I'm speaking with constitutional law scholar Vic Amar. He's dean of the University of Illinois Law School. We're talking about the Electoral College. And Vic, you made a really interesting point about the popular vote and the way that we structure presidential campaigns, right? Because it's interesting to think that, I think from a layperson's perspective, they would think, well, it's a presidential campaign. Everyone votes for who they're going to vote for. Does it really matter where people are campaigning for? But you're saying that the entire process is devised around gaining electoral college votes, and that's where the bulk of attention kind of goes to.
Yeah, indeed. You look at the strategies of the candidates, and there's a reason why they spend time only in states that are close that have a significant number of electors, so-called swing states of significance. So none of the candidates spend any time in California or Texas or New York because the outcome of those states is foreordained.
Or Illinois,
for example. Think about how little attention the state of Illinois, its issues, its voters, its desires got because everyone knew from the start that Hillary Clinton would win Illinois, whether she won 55-45 or 60-40 or 62-38. There's always some suspense as to the margin of victory, but the margin of victory doesn't matter because every state, except for Nebraska and Maine, who are just some odd historical exceptions, every state adopts what's called a winner-take-all approach, wherein the entire basket of that state's electors goes to the winning candidate.
So I guess that gets to the point of what you think about the Electoral College. You've criticized it in the past. You actually raised three different issues with the Electoral College in your article. Can you explain those? We kind of touched on one of them, which is that voters are treated unfairly. So, the process inherently has set up for the fact that voters in some states get no attention.
So we've actually touched on all three. So one is that voters are not treated equally around the country, even though they're all voting for the same office of president. So the votes in some states matter more than others, whether it's because they're a swing state and getting more attention or because they're a small state and they have an overrepresentation in the Electoral College. Second, the campaigns are not really waged to deal with issues all across the country, but rather only in those several swing states that could go either way. So the desires, the wishes, the voices of people throughout a lot of parts of the country aren't really being heard. And then third is this question of independence of the electors and faithlessness of the electors. I think it's a problem that we have these unknown, untested, unaccountable electors. No one knows who these electors
are.
Right,
and how do they get picked? These end up being people picked by the parties?
Yeah, the political parties pick people to serve as electors. It's kind of a reward for party loyalty. It's you give elector status to someone in the party if they're doing a lot of work for you or if they have connections or they helped raise money, etc.
So they're just normal people.
They're just normal people, and they're not all particularly experienced or accomplished. They run the gamut. I mean, you have some who are young students. You have some who are retired folks. But they're unknown to the voters. They're unaccountable to the voters because they're not going to have to run for reelection, or they don't have a public salary they have to worry about losing. And they're not particularly skilled at discerning the will of the national electorate. So even if we wanted to have a system where we picked some select group of wise individuals, men and women, to intermediate between the voters and the office of the president and try to pick someone who's really good for the president and just use the voter input as one piece of information, but not the only piece. Even if we wanted to have that system, we wouldn't tap all these unknown folks that we call electors. We would give a lot more thought to who should be that intermediate group.
There's an argument, though, about the Electoral College system. In the beginning of the hour, for the first part of the show, to introduce the show, we actually played a piece of tape from NPR's Cookie Roberts, mm-hmm. who argued that if there was no Electoral College, this is a system that actually protects minorities, both racial and geographic minorities, right? Because if there was no Electoral College, elections probably would just take place among the biggest population centers along the coasts, in the media. Do you think that the Electoral College provides a sense of equality?
Not really. That's the way states apportioned their districts before the 1960s. They said, well, we don't want all the clout to come from the big cities, so we are going to give every county a certain number of state legislators. And that resulted in a situation where urban voters had much less voice than rural voters, and voters of color had much less votes than white voters. That's how we got to one person, one vote in the Supreme Court in the 1960s. In Baker versus Carr and Reynolds versus Sims. So to say that an election that is a true national popular election will cater to the places where the people are is just another way of saying it's democratic. Democracy should value the voices of the more over the voices of the few. And the fact that the more might live in certain areas doesn't really negate that in any way.
And so you have promoted the idea of what's called a national popular vote plan. How would that work?
So the key element of the Electoral College under the Constitution is that it's driven by the way each state wants to pick and allocate its electors. I think amending the Constitution to get rid of the Electoral College is a non-starter.
It's just not going to happen.
Because you need three-quarters of the states to sign on. And small states and larger swing states that feel they benefit from the current system are not going to want to change.
Right. You're never going to get Florida
or Ohio
right.
or Pennsylvania. Those states benefit from the system, and I understand why they wouldn't want to change. But remember, every state currently tells its electors to vote for the person who won the most votes in that state. But a state could tell its electors instead, vote for the candidate who won the most votes nationwide. And if enough states signed on to an agreement to allocate their electors based on who won the national popular vote rather than who won the vote in each of the respective states, then as few as 11 states could in effect bring about a national popular election. If the 11 largest states all agreed that they would give their electors to the person who won the most votes nationwide, regardless of who won the most votes in those 11 states, then that accounts for more than 270 electors needed to elect a president.
So, wouldn't that effectively negate their power in the Electoral College, though? Wouldn't that essentially be the same thing as giving up their power in the Electoral College?
It really wouldn't be a cession of power, but there is a sense that states wouldn't want to do this alone, which is why the NPV plan that's out there, of which there are 10 states plus the D.C. as signatories, accounting for, I think, 165 electors, more than half of the 270 they need, that plan comes into effect only when there are a requisite number of states who've signed on to it. So no state is unilaterally disarming by giving its electors to the national popular vote winner over the winner in the state, unless and until there are enough states to do that. But as I said, the movement is more than half the way there. If people are interested, they should go visit the National Popular Vote Compact website. And there's Republicans as well as Democrats who have endorsed this. This is the only plausible reform I see on the horizon.
Vic Amar is dean of the University of Illinois Law School, filling us in on his thoughts. We'll tweet out all of those links, by the way. If you follow 21ST Show, you can see all of the things we've been talking about. On Monday, the vote happens. We've just got a few seconds left, Vic, but I assume you're going to predict that the vote's going to go the way it should.
I would be shocked if there are a very large number of faithless electors. There'll be a few, but I think people need to understand that Donald Trump is going to be president unless he takes ill or something, and that's what's going to happen.
Thanks to Vic Amar. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. I'm Nyla Booter.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, supporting librarianship and the training of librarians, instructing instructors as they embed the library into classrooms and beyond the campus across the globe. The University Library at Illinois.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's a time of year for buying gifts for family or friends or for that white elephant gift exchange your workplace is planning. I'm pretty sure that the two librarians who I'm joined by right now will agree with me when I say that a book can make a wonderful holiday gift. They're here with us to share their recommendations. On the line from the Chicago suburbs is Liz Kirchhoff. She's an adult services librarian at the Barrington Area Library. Liz, welcome back to The 21st.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Joining me in studio is Deborah Stevenson. She's the director of the Center for Children's Books at the University of Illinois, where she's also an assistant professor in the School of Library and Information Sciences, or the iSchool. Deborah, welcome. Thanks for being here, too.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Before we get to each of your top picks, because you picked sort of adults and kids, I feel like I have a question for you. I feel like you need to know someone pretty well to buy a book for them. And I feel like there aren't very many books I would give to just anyone. I think in the case of children's books, you can maybe always go with a classic. But what do you think, Liz?
Yeah, so I think it's nice if you have a really good conversation with them first. So a lot of the people who come up to my desk at the library, I don't really know them, but we'll talk a little bit before I start recommending books. So we talk about, like, what do they like? What shows do they like if they aren't a big reader? You kind of get a feel for what they're interested in, for what they like to read, what they're you know, anything like that. Do they have a long commute? Do they like audiobooks, ebooks? All those things can kind of tell you a little bit about them.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just sort of looking for some clues. And that's the same thing sort of with your friends that you're buying for your family members. You're just kind of looking for some clues. You can always kind of fall back on those bestsellers. That can be really, really helpful. Sometimes I'll pull out the things that I know I'm getting asked for a lot. People really, really love to read what everybody else is reading because it's fun to be able to say, say, yeah, I read that and that was great. You know, it just makes you feel good. It makes you feel like you're like real with it. So those can be really good too. And they can give you clues as the person sort of says, you know, maybe not for me, or they get excited.
Deborah, what do you think about for children? Is there for teenagers? Do you have similar advice? How do you figure that out?
Well, I think obviously you have a better chance at getting a book that will connect if you know the person really well, but books are a really low impact error. It's not the end of the world if you give a kid a book, and it's not their kind of book, and it happens to grown-ups too, as I'm sure Liz will attest.
Absolutely.
What's interesting about the bestseller lists when you're looking at kids' books is that the lower you go in age range, the farther away it becomes from kids' actual choices. The picture book bestseller list usually have something about manners, a holiday book.
That's what parents are buying or adults are buying for children.
Yeah,
right.
And there might be a couple in that the kids really like, but they're not the best source. Whereas if you go up into the ones where the kids are spending their own coin, they're a much better sense of what's really popular with kids.
Oh,
so
that's interesting.
Middle grade stuff YA, yeah, that's really popular with the kids.
Oh, okay. So let's start with one adult book and then we'll do one kid's book. Liz, you came up with a great list. By the way, we will tweet all of these lists out so everyone can see all of them. If you follow 21ST Show, we'll also have it up at our website at 21stshow.org. But Liz, let's start with your first pick, To the Bright Edge of the World. I've never heard about this.
Oh, I love this book. Yeah. So the author also wrote The Snow Child, which was huge a couple of years ago. Also a great pick for this time of the year, obviously, lots of snow. So she writes a lot about Alaska, and that's what this one is about. So it's the winter of 1885, and you have this couple, Colonel Allen and then his wife, Sophie, and he's always sort of wanted to explore the Alaskan territories, and his wife is just this kind of amazing person. So he finally gets the go-ahead, and he leaves on this exploration, and she is pregnant, and she's just this awesome, awesome character. So she, to me, is what totally makes this book. She's really plucky. She wants to learn a bit about, like, the anatomy of this baby that she's having, and her doctor says no. So she breaks into his office and steals one of his books. She just doesn't care what other people think, and I just loved that about her. This author is just beautiful. Her writing is gorgeous. She's very accessible. This is a really good pick for folks who like historical fiction, as well as people who really like books that are written a lot in letter and journal form. Those tend to be really popular, and this is a unique pick for those folks.
Okay, we're talking holiday books. If you have suggestions of books you like to buy for people, whether they're for adults or children, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet them as well to 21STShow. Deborah, what about, I was looking at this list. It was so interesting. We were just talking about this before we went on air. These are all really new titles to me, so I'd love to hear more about these. Can you tell us about Thunder Boy Jr.?
Thunder Boy Jr. is by the famous Sherman Alexie, who is deserving of every bit of praise he gets, as far as I'm concerned. And this is a gorgeous little picture book that speaks to pretty much every kid, really, who has ever felt shadowed by their parents. So this is Thunder Boy, who's Thunder Boy Jr., and his dad is Thunder Boy, so he's Thunder Boy Sr., and he wants his own name. He loves his dad. His dad is wonderful, but he wants to be his own person. And it's this really cool family. They're on motorbikes. They're doing their stuff. The art by Gigi Morales is just beautiful without being prissy. It's got a real contemporary flair to it. And it's really speaking in a gently comic way, both to the desire for individuation and also the desire to be understood. My favorite lines in this book is when they figure out what they're going to do. And the kid who's the narrator says, "My dad read my mind. My dad read my heart." Don't we all want our parents to read our heart?
That's really sweet. So this is Thunder Boy Jr. It's for ages 4 to 7 years. How do you go by when you're trying to think about age range for kids? Do you go by what the author says the age range is? Or how do you guys figure that out?
In general, the ages that are on the back of the book are going to be
those
as broad
are pretty
as
good?
Possible.
Oh.
They might go a little broad because they want to sell to as wide as possible. And obviously, if you know an individual reader's capability, that's going to skew things. You'll have young readers who read up for fantasy. You'll have readers who, for what they're interested in, if it's more visual, they'll read down. But for picture books, I think most of them, we kind of talk about the 4 to 7, 5 to 8 range. And also picture books are almost always going to be mediated by an adult. So that means you're going to have a look at the book while you're sharing it anyway. Mm-hmm.
Liz, what's another book that you have on your list?
Yes, yeah, so I have the book A Promise of Fire, and it's a really interesting book that I threw out there. This is one that I feel like I recommend an awful lot for kind of that new adult crowd. So you're talking like in their 20s, you know, they're probably still reading some young adult books, but they're kind of like a little past sort of the content that a young adult book would have. So in A Promise of Fire, you have your main character whose name is Kat, and she's a kingmaker. So what that means is she can tell when anyone is lying. So this is obviously a fantasy. It's a bit of a romance. And she is just the best character. I really love books, especially fantasies, that have sort of these strong characters, and I love that she's often the savior of everybody else. So, you know, these big armies, they just need her to help them, to save them. There's lots and lots of action. It's a fairly new book. It got great reviews, good customer reviews on Amazon. It's a pretty easy read, and the next book is coming out in January, so you're seeing some folks who are already pretty excited.
Oh, right.
About
it's good timing, right?
Yeah,
way they've done
absolutely.
That. How do you feel about Amazon reviews? Do you trust them for books?
Well, it depends. So I will look at them just to sort of see if there are some themes there. That's mostly what I'm looking at. I'm not so much looking at the star reviews, you know, when they say it's 4 or 5. Not so much that. I'm looking at what people are actually saying within the reviews themselves. I think the same thing with Goodreads, any of those sites that do book reviews.
Mm-hmm. Deborah, what about you? What do you have next on your list?
I'm a huge advocate for nonfiction because I think sometimes we can get in a little bit of a fiction rut when we're thinking about recommendations. So Pamela Turner's Samurai Rising, The Epic Life of Minamoto Yoshitsune is a galloping adventure story that is absolutely completely true. And it is about the 12th century warrior Minamoto Yoshitsune, who was in the vanguard of the samurai movement. And it is the most battle-soaked, fast-paced, historically imbued, but blood-thumping adventure that I have read this year.
Wow. And that's for grades. You have grades 5 to 10?
Yeah, one of
probably
the advantages
because there's a little bit of violence, I guess.
Yeah, more than a little bit.
Okay.
but it's also, nonfiction often spreads a bit wider than fiction because the interest is so broad and it's often less dependent on style. And Turner writes with great verve and a lovely sense of humor. So there's a little bit of detachment. And a lot of the kids who really like samurais, aside from the fact that obviously the subject will draw them, will really enjoy this as a reading experience.
Mm. Now, you have, speaking of nonfiction, Liz, there's a pick on here that I love that you had, and it's a graphic novel. It's March, book 1 by John Lewis. And it's interesting because I guess I've always thought because it's a graphic novel, this is a gift that I've given to a lot of teenagers, and especially this is a gift I've given to some of my nephews who are a little bit younger. Can you tell us about March 1?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a book that was definitely written for the teen crowd, but I've given this to lots and lots of adults, actually. So this is okay for adults. It's okay for teens. It really, I think, has a wide, wide spread of appeal. This is actually the first comic book, I believe, that's ever won the National Book Award. So this trilogy is about Congressman John Lewis, and he's very well known for his nonviolent protests against segregation, basically. So these three books follow him through his quest, essentially, to make his voice heard. So what I love about them is, you know, historically they're very important, but they also sort of help you understand who he is as a guy. Like, he's just a very personable individual, and you can really see why he had the wide impact that he did. They're really phenomenal.
Yeah, I love the artwork. The artwork's really incredible.
And it's really just very unique artwork. It really, really it really lends itself to the story. It rises to the story and helps the story even become more than it was. I was really uncertain when I saw the first book and the subject matter, but it just works beautifully together.
Deborah, you have a book of poetry on here I was hoping you could talk about. It's called Wet Cement, A Mix of Concrete Poems.
I really like poetry. There's a lot of great poetry written for young people. Bob Brezka is working on concrete poems, poems laid out on the page in ways that convey the point as much as the words within them. So he does some beautiful, very simple stuff that attracts, I think, both young people who are interested in the artistry of layout and seeing how you can play with words on a page. So he's just... got a few words, and of course, I meant to write down a sample, and I didn't. He's got one about poetry, and I think it ends up with an O.
okay.
But he'll do things like reductive lines, so it'll go down to just a few letters, or he'll lay it out in a spiral if it's a spiraling activity, or they'll be crossed. So it looks kind of like a picture book.
It's really interesting.
The one thing that's advantageous there, too, is that kids who maybe aren't that thrilled to see a line of dense text, but also don't want to be handed a baby book. There's a lot of white space, but there's something really smart going on.
So you have that for grades 2 to 5, you think?
Yeah, that's pretty early for concrete poems, but
okay.
He's doing them very accessibly for early grades.
So you think second graders can handle that?
Yeah.
Liz, you have a nonfiction book on here that I've been meaning to get to all year, which I haven't, Evicted by Matthew Desmond. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, absolutely. I highly, highly recommend this book. It's won tons of awards this year, and it was just marvelous. This is going to be a really good pick for your social justice crowd. Really, anybody in our area, because this is so regional, this will be very interesting to them. So the author of this book spent several years in Milwaukee, and what he was studying was the cycle of eviction. So what does an eviction do to a family? What does it do to an individual? How does it impact their life down the road and their children and all of these things? So, you know, you get a lot of sort of what you expect from a book like this, but you also hear from the landlord. You hear from one gentleman, which just really stuck with me. He was a nurse, and he was a very, very well-regarded nurse, very well-respected. And he hurt his back helping a patient move from the bed, and he developed an opioid addiction. And when he got cut off from his doctors, then he developed a drug addiction and lost his home. And once he lost his home, he lost his job. And you just really sort of start to understand that cycle and kind of how that spiral can happen. You know, once this one bad thing happens, people are so prone and so likely to have more of these tough things happen. He talks a lot about single moms and kind of gives some solutions at the end of the book. It's a tough, thorny issue. You know, people, they need to be paid, of course. You know, you have to pay your rent, but there also has to be more fail safe. There needs to be more nets for people who just cannot make ends meet. I found it fascinating. It was extremely accessible and so timely right now.
So that's Evicted.
So a great gift. Yeah.
Yeah, we're almost out of time. So we'll tweet out the whole list of everybody, but I just want to ask both of you really quickly, what are you reading or giving over the holidays to people? Deborah?
It's actually one of the books on my list. It's Martin Stewart's Riverkeep. People who miss the late, great Terry Pratchett know there's nothing exactly like him, but it's an immersive rural early British fantasy where a boy's father is taken over by a river demon.
Wow. And Liz, how about you?
Yeah, I'm absolutely doing To the Bright Edge of the World. I've given that out a couple of times this holiday season. I just loved it. I thought it was beautiful. Just a really, really special book.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I should mention the iSchool at the University of Illinois puts out what you guys call a guidebook to gift books. And there's an annotated list of more than 300 children's book recommendations divided by age groups. So we'll tweet that out for everyone as well. Thank you for being with me. Happy holidays.
Thank you. You too.
Happy holidays. Thank you.
Thanks to Liz Kirshoff and Deborah Stevenson. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
You're listening to The 21st.
Silent night, holy night, shepherds quake at the sight, glory stream from heaven afar, heavenly sing hallelujah.
That's the voice of Lucy Smith. She's a Chicago-based singer, composer, and band leader, and a jazz musician who just, along with her quartet, released her latest album. It's called Singing Christmas by the Lucy Smith Quartet. And Lucy is on the line with us now from Chicago. Hi, Lucy. Welcome to The 21st.
Thanks for having me, Nyla.
So I should say so much of this album comes from your work arranging music for the jazz service at Fourth Presbyterian Church in Chicago, which is, I should disclose to our audience, partially how you and I know each other. You're the music director for that service. How much did that work influence this album?
Oh, dramatically so. I mean, it's been about, what, 6.5, going on 7 years at that position and making music for that service. And over that time period, I've, you know, arranged and rearranged, you know, so many pieces of music, and it's really given me an opportunity to just really think about the music differently, you know, because, you know, some of it's pretty, aside from it being sacred music, it's also people think that sometimes music that we sing over and over again or for particular occasions, we shouldn't necessarily touch too much. But I had some space to really explore a little bit more and experiment in studio with the guys. I mean, the musicians I work with are just incredible. And we gave space for each other so that we could make something new sometimes.
Well, when you talk about space and also the notion of whether it's sacred music or, and I think whether it's like sacred holiday music or secular holiday music, we do have sometimes, I think, a very strong nostalgia attached to songs, and we like them the way that they are. And I wanted to ask you about, you have two versions of Silent Night on this album. And the first one has, I wouldn't say it's silences, but it has space in it. And it's not the Silent Night that I think people kind of know when they're thinking of that. Why was that important to you?
Okay, so that's kind of like the penultimate Christmas song, right? Well, I guess it depends on who you're talking to. But
for you it is, sure.
For me it is. And it's the song, I think, that really speaks the message of the season. And also, I mean, I was raised Catholic. And, you know, it also, you know, tells this wonderful story of the story, the Christmas story of what it's originally supposed to be. And so I really wanted to find a way to articulate that with the music. But I have to be completely honest before I start getting all, you know, cerebral about it. When we were in the studio for Silent Night, I turned to the guys and I'm like, what you got? And they're like, I don't have anything. And I was like, okay, fine. So I'm in a separate room, and I yelled at Michael, the drummer. I'm like, okay, Michael, it's you and me, baby. It's you and me up top. And he started playing, and I started singing. And then the bass player and the piano player, Ryan and Marchin, then joined us. And that's how the first take happened. And then the second take kind of has a similar shape, but definitely a different feel.
Yeah, and why did you have two takes of that? And what did you think? Did you just do those two takes? Is that something where you thought, I like the both of these takes, so both of them are going to end up on the album?
Yes to both of your questions. There were only two takes, and I could not make up my mind.
Well, when you think about that, Lucy, I mean, thinking about making up your mind, when you think about Christmas songs to choose from, how did you narrow down the 13 tracks that you have on this album?
I don't know how I did it, to be honest with you, Nyla. I mean, some of them were arrangements that I had. And some of it, you know, some holiday music has more of the hip factor than others. There's one track that's called Gabriel's Message. Or it's also called the Angel Gabriel. And I think this one goes back to like the 11th or 12th century or something. It is some of the most hippest music, both melodically and harmonically, that I've encountered in a long time. It changes meter. There's so many opportunities to do wonderful things harmonically with it. And so we just really had fun. So that's a factor, you know, the hipness of the tune itself.
And did you want to think, I mean, there are different sort of sensibilities. You kind of do run a range on this album. Did you just think like this one's a little more slow and meditative, so we need to kind of kick it up a notch?
You're talking about the feel or the arrangement?
I think just with the different pieces that you selected.
Well, I mean, I think that any album should have some diversity and good diversity. I mean, it has to flow, and I hope that the order of the tunes do flow. I feel confident that they do, actually.
Do you think it's important on a Christmas album where people are familiar with the songs to have kind of a good ebb and flow? Because you also have some songs that maybe aren't
the
as familiar. Right.
I think it's important as artists that we do that, especially for a holiday thing. I mean, there is so much Christmas music out there, so much holiday music, depending on. And I was talking to a gentleman the other day. He's collected over 2,000 individual pieces of music just about Christmas. And I just listened to a little bit of it, and so much of it is stuff that I haven't heard. So I think sometimes it's our call as artists to do both of those things, to let people refamiliarize themselves, but then also present new information so we can, have that feeling too. Music is stuff that you can't really touch, right? But you definitely can feel it, and we feel different things when we hear new stuff, or even we feel stuff we're like, oh, I know what that is, but it's just a little different, you know.
Well, that said, let's take a listen to your version. This is Lucy Smith Quartet. It Came Upon the Midnight Clear. That's It Came Upon a Midnight Clear from the Lucy Smith Quartet. Lucy Smith is with us. She's a Chicago-based jazz singer, composer, and band leader. The album is called Singing Christmas. It's out now. Lucy, it takes a lot of time to produce an album and finalize everything, as we've been talking about, everything you put into this. Did you record these Christmas songs, I imagine, not in winter? How long did it take to put this together?
We actually went into the studio in early September. Believe it or not, this is the first time that I've ever done something so...
Wow, it was really fast.
Yes. Kind of whirlwindish, actually. A lot of things fell into place, and I did a lot of self-funding, and so that's why I was also able to do, I guess I should call it credit card funding, to get this one out. So,
wow.
I thought that it would be, you know, if we recorded in September, I would shoot for the following year, but...
You were fast.
You know, just based on everything that's going on in the world, the stuff that we don't necessarily need to talk about, but I know that you know what I'm talking about, I felt that it was something that I could contribute to the vibe of what's going on right now.
And is there a particular kind of emotion that you feel when you hear Christmas music that you wanted to convey to everybody or that you wanted to leave with people as they heard your music?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I hope this doesn't sound generic, but... There's something about the holiday season, you know, regardless of where you are on the religious spectrum, on the cultural spectrum, you know, it's an opportunity for us to actually look at each other in the face and greet each other, and talk about, and even if it's in a generic way, to say things about love and peace and community and togetherness. And the overarching theme in the majority of the tunes that are on Singing Christmas just reek of love and peace. And it's kind of really crucial to articulate that right now.
Let's take one last listen to the album. This is the Christmas classic, Do You Hear What I Hear?, arranged by the Lucy Smith Quartet, which performs at the album. It's called Singing Christmas. Lucy, thanks for being with us. Merry Christmas.
Thank you, Nyla. Merry Christmas to you, too.
Said the night wind to the little lamb, do you see what I see? Way up in the sky, little lamb, do you see what I see? A star, dancing in the night with a tail as big as a kite. With a tail as big as a kite. Said the little lamb to the shepherd boy, do you hear what I hear? Ringing through the night, shepherd boy, what I hear? A song, high above the trees, with a voice as big as the sea, with a voice as big as the sea.
That does it for us today and for this week. We're back on Monday, and for the next 2 weeks, we've got a series of our favorite shows we picked from the past year, 21st Encores for you throughout the holidays. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app if you search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, every other way to contact us is at our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Howla Delahi, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help, and special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Have a great weekend.